going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive, up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
That's right, it is the Going Deep podcast. I am Donovan Bennett, and it is that time of year. It's my favorite time of year from a sports perspective. F1 season has started, baseball, spring training is ending, real games, well, in different countries, real games have started, but real games in North America starting soon. Playoff races heating up in the NBA, the NHL, the PWHL. NSL kits have been revealed, and there are some fire ones. Shout out to Montreal and AFC Toronto. The Masters are just around the corner. Hello, friends. But really, what I'm most excited for is the March Madness tournament, both on the men's and women's side. Lots of intrigue, lots of Canadians, lots of real good Canadians. In fact, 20 of which on the men's side, and quite frankly, this is the time of year when I don't want to work. I want to sit at home on a couch and watch game after game after game. The only reason I am at work is to talk about this tournament in person with someone who knows it real well, not just because he's running the pool of record here at Sportsnet, because he's watching all throughout the year, is Daniele Franceschi, producer and host here at Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Daniele, thank you so much for being here. What excites you about this time of year?
First and foremost, my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Donovan. Always great to be on with you. And at certainly this time of year, the best time of year. I think with this tournament, it's a combination of the natural intrigue because the games matter so much, and you're watching kids play with a ton of passion and energy and enthusiasm. And I feel like the quality of basketball is always really darn good. Unpopular opinion. I mean, I'd much rather watch a college game right now than an NBA game for obvious reasons. Not because the NBA stinks. No, because if we look at it, what are the stakes? The stakes are so high with these games. And then we add the second layer of, inevitably, there are going to be surprises. There are going to be upsets. There are going to be great stories. And so that's what really captivates my interest year over year. Regardless of what we're talking about when it comes to this tournament, we can try and prognosticate all we want. But truthfully, we have no clue what's going to happen. We can do our best to try and decide or help explain and break it down. But man, it's the gift that keeps on giving. That's how I try to frame it every year, is the gift that keeps on giving with unexpected turns along the way.
There's so much good stuff there to follow. One, I actually, in a way, I don't think the quality of basketball is always great. I think the quality of effort is great. Mm-hmm. Quality of intensity is great. And you talked about the stakes. The stakes and storylines are clear and they are great. I talk about this all the time. Kate Fagan came on the podcast years ago now and talked about her TED Talk about stakes and storylines. And that's why we are into things. And although there's probably a better level of basketball being played night in, night out in the G League, mm-hmm. the March Madness tournament is just a much better brand because we clearly understand the stakes, the storylines, and some of the players are brand name, household names. Mm-hmm. But I actually think some of the beauty of the tournament is that it is messy. This is not clean. It's not controlled. That mistakes happen, and thus that leads to incredible collapses or incredible comebacks, incredible drama and intrigue. I love the imperfect nature of it. It makes it a great television product and essentially a reality show. And I also love that as much as you think you might know, you really don't know, because this is young people with lots of pressure and you're not sure how they're going to react. And in my household, there's going to be a couple brackets. There's going to be, you know, my bracket with my head and my bracket with my heart. Some people feel you need a bracket of integrity. I say, forget you. You need to hedge your bets. But also, you know, my one son is going to have a bracket based off of colors that he likes. The other son's going to have a bracket based off of mascots that he likes. My wife is going to have a bracket based off of places she'd like to visit. And I'm quite sure that those brackets are going to do better than mine.
Probably. Yeah.
And my bracket is going to be ripped up. By the time you hear this, quite frankly, my bracket may have been ripped up. By the first session on the first day,
it
might be done. A big question, though, in terms of that uncertainty this year, is injury. You talked about the comparison and the contrast of the college game to the NBA game. I think one of the biggest ones is there's no load management. There's no nursing someone back from injury. There's going to be a lot of people who are going to play with some injuries, and how well is the question. Or if they're held out for the opening rounds, that might make a difference on if their team sees the second weekend. In terms of the injury news, what about it intrigues you and has you looking at the tournament maybe a bit differently if everyone was healthy and available?
Yeah, okay. So I think that's an important question to ask. Number one, first and foremost, is what's happening with Cooper Flagg, which it looks like he's going to be fine, and I would expect he'll be okay. Malik Brown, there hasn't been a lot of discussion or updates in terms of his status. He's kind of quietly a really important player for Duke. So if he's available, clearly that boosts their stock even more than what it currently is. And the potential of getting to a Final Four as a team that's really polished and balanced, it increases exponentially with those two guys in the lineup. I think Flagg will be there. I'm less certain about Malik Brown. The other one to me that is really big, also somewhat under discussed, but maybe they dodged a bullet here for the first time in years, but Houston and Juwan Roberts. Juwan Roberts is their best player. He's their best offensive player. You ask the question for Houston, a team that predicates itself on defense. When they need a bucket, who are they going to? It's Juwan Roberts. And they somehow won the Big 12 tournament without him being available and a presence in their lineup. But at the same time, they will desperately need him and everything he provides if they want to make a deep run, if they want to finally exercise some of those demons in March and perhaps get Kelvin Sampson his elusive NCAA championship that he's been searching for throughout his career up until this point. And another one similar, a higher seed, but has implications when it comes to a team that is looking to get back to the Final Four for the second straight year, Alabama and Grant Nelson. Grant Nelson was so darn good last year for Alabama and really came out of nowhere because he was a bit of a unheralded sort of recruit that was brought in by Nate Oates as a guy that was a transfer, a veteran with plenty of experience on his resume, but his ability to stretch the floor and also be this massive hulking presence inside, that's a tremendous asset to have. So if he's good to go, you'll feel much better about Alabama, who has their warts defensively and loves to play fast and go up and down. They need a guy like that to be a stabilizer for them. So those are the ones that kind of stick out the most in my mind, Donovan, when it comes to the injury front and monitoring those situations. I do think overall we're fortunate that it's not as much of a pronounced issue as it has been in years past. Like I think about Houston. I already referenced them, but look at what's happened the last couple of years. I've been so high on the way the Cougars play, on the foundation of their program, certainly their illustrious head coach and the career he's had. And if anybody deserves one, he's up there with Mark Few. They deserve that one to add to the resume. And last year was Jamal Shedd. Year before it was Marcus Sasser. So they've had this issue where they've been a number one seed, one of the best teams in the country, and they start limping into the tournament and it costs them. Maybe they win a game or two, but then they get burnt because their depth is in question due to the injury. So I think we're looking at a really, really fun tournament here because all the key proprietary figures are going to be healthy and available for their teams. And I hope it stays that way.
You mentioned Houston, and if you just look over the balance of the last 3 years, pick a metric, you can make an argument. They've been the most consistent, you know, the best team in the sport, but they have nothing yet to show for it. Part of me thinks law of averages says they have to.
At some point
get through. Plus, this is the year, if healthy, they have the offense to balance with that defense. But also part of me said, well, listen, they haven't done it. I'm going to go in another direction, and it's conversation we had about Gonzaga for a long time. Until you do it, I'm just going to bet that at some point you're not going to. Where are you with that in terms of a field where, you know, it's it's pretty top heavy in, on the one line and two lines in terms of teams that could win it all. You can make an argument for them could win it all. Where are you in terms of Houston being able to break through in a year where the finals 3 hours from their campus?
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't necessarily helped teams in the past.
Historically, yeah.
Historically, but it's still a factor. Where are you with this being potentially their year?
Yeah, historically, no team that has played in their home state has ever won the national championship. When the Final Four has been staged in their home state, it's never happened. So history is going against, working against the Houston Cougars here. They're the, out of all the one seeds, they're the team I'm most afraid of. They're the team I think has the most vulnerable draw on their side of the bracket. If they had to, and this is all predicated on one thing in particular, Gonzaga beats Georgia, and we set up a round of 32 matchup on the weekend between Houston and Gonzaga. That feels like the game where either the narrative, the existing narrative of Houston can't win the big ones in March, either gets reinforced again, or they're able to exercise that proverbial demon and push through. Truthfully, I don't know. I'm conflicted on that. I'm conflicted on the ability for them to win that game. I can also envision a world where, yeah, Gonzaga goes in there, and they've got quality shot makers, and they've also got a really good seasoned coach. And by the way, that Gonzaga team, better than the group that they had last year. They still have to get through Georgia, so I'm not going to overlook that matchup because it is an 8-9 on paper. I don't want to bypass that altogether. But for me, out of all the one seeds, because of the draw, Houston is the most susceptible to one of those early exits. If they happen to get beyond that second round, where in theory you could see a Gonzaga, then I think it opens the doors for them to finally kind of shake off all those years, all that weight that's been on their shoulders, that's been mounting to say, we beat a really good team in the second round. The pathway exists for us to go and make a deep run again. Let's go do it. Let's get back to the Final Four. We have, and as you mentioned, the key with them this year, what's been a little bit different compared to teams of yesteryear with the Houston Cougars, now they're going to spread you out on the offensive end. They're not going to be a team that, yes, although Juwan Roberts is technically their best player and their most potent offensive threat, they shoot the three at an exceptionally high rate, and they still defend with that same patented Houston style of defense. And when you combine those two, it does give you the ingredients for a team that can make a run. But boy, oh boy, I hate the fact that the committee put us in a position, Donovan, where Gonzaga is potentially staring at them in a second-round matchup. Because if I start, I go back to what I said even at the beginning with regards to Houston. When you need a bucket, chips are down in a close game, which I do believe if those two teams met, it would be a close game. Who is Kelvin Sampson turning to get a bucket? It's probably Juwan Roberts, number one. Number two on that list, probably Milos Uzan. They're not going to put it in Emmanuel Sharpe's hands to go get a bucket. He'll go stand in space because he's an unbelievable three-point shooter. Those are their main two guys. Go get a bucket if they need it. LJ Cryer, veteran guy, he's probably third on that list. Okay, how about Gonzaga? Well, Graham Ike can get it inside if you need it. How about Caleb Battle, I think he pronounces it Caleb Battle, transfer from Arkansas. God, he's got a little Caleb love in him. I'm a big fan. You got Ryan Nemhard, of course. You've got Nolan Hickman. The depth that the Zags have, it just gives me that moment for pause when I've been, and I've been doing this all week long, getting to that point in the bracket and saying, gosh, am I really doing this? Like, am I going to take... whoever wins a matchup of that magnitude in the second round legitimately has the ceiling of a Final Four team. I truly believe that. And that's why I think Houston, out of all the one seeds, has the toughest draw. It's a product of what their matchup might look like. I look at where Auburn is. Sure, could they have some hiccups and a few challenges along the way? Of course. But I think they are still a supremely better team than a lot of the opponents they're going to see. Florida, probably the most complete balanced team. Duke, talk about the resume. It's flawless, especially if they can get Cooper Flagg back in there. You like their chances even more. So Houston is the one that I'm circling as a vulnerable potential threat to be ousted rather early, depending on who they see.
It's funny. You look at that 8-9 game, and I can see both the winner of that game, Gonzaga or Georgia, making a run to the Sweet 16. Or one of them, obviously. One of them will be out in the first round without a win. And Houston might, in a way, get a reprieve if they do survive the winner of Gonzaga, Georgia. I think, you know, the winner of Clemson, Purdue might be an easier game for them. But then lurking after that is a winner, and we're really getting ahead of ourselves here, of a potential Kentucky-Tennessee matchup, you know, how good the SEC has been this year. So to your point, the bracket not necessarily in their favor, even though the Final Four, if they get there, is considered home game. You mentioned Sharp, and mm-hmm. maybe you may have upset some Canadian fans who think maybe he should have a bit of a higher usage rate and not be a catch-and-shoot player. His rise is, I think, maybe the story of the tournament in terms of Canadians. Nembhard is a known quantity, certainly. Mm. But a lot of Canadians in the tournament have really grinded and gone out the mud, put themselves in position to be contributors in rotation players. Not the tournament of the past where Zach Edey is, you know, the best player in the country, RJ Barrett on a team that could win a championship and, you know, he's going to be a lottery pick. It's not a tournament like that. Not a tournament we're dreaming. Could we get Tyler Ennis and Wiggins in the final, which we obviously didn't. It didn't come close. you know, could we see, you know, Corey Joseph and Tristan Thompson take a team to a final? It's not like that, but there are, around the bracket, some real interesting Canadians who are contributors. Who jumps out to you of the 20 in the field that Canadians should be keeping their eyes on?
I mean, if we consider Emmanuel Sharpe and Aiden Holloway true Canadians,
we're taking them. Hey, this is the era of the dual national. Look at our soccer team.
That's fair. Now, Aiden Holloway, I would say, by the way, of course, he's a sophomore guard at Alabama, played at Auburn last year and has the stain, if you will, of losing to Yale in the first round a year ago. So seeking some tournament success. Very important player for Alabama because he comes off the bench. He's a scorer and is a really, really good, stable, calming presence coming off the bench for Alabama. I like him.
I still can't believe he transferred from Auburn, Alabama. I know it's not football.
Yeah,
but it's still the same state.
Era of NIL.
I guess.
Right?
Yeah,
and also to think he went from a starting role. He played more than 2/3 of the games last year as a starter for Auburn and a team that was really good. Obviously, they're entering the tournament this year as the number one overall seed. He transfers to Alabama, where he's now coming off the bench, mm-hmm. and his role has changed. Still very effective and important, but different role altogether. So now, in his case, though, in terms of his Canadian status, if you will, you know, his mom actually lived in Toronto, grew mm-hmm. up here, played basketball, university basketball in Toronto. So there's a true lineage there.
Varsity Blues legend.
Right. Hall of Famer. Emmanuel Sharp, a little bit different. That's a loose connection. Regardless, though, I think if we're looking at it, the three best players in terms of the Canadians that are in the field, it would certainly be Nembhard, Holloway, and Sharp. If we're looking for guys on the periphery that you might sort of say, oh, you know what? Forgot about him, but he kind of plays sneakily a very important role for his team. A guy that I really think is vital, and certainly standalone even in the first round, because we've seen this team be selected as a potential upset opportunity. Keyshawn Bartholomew at Oregon, who's a senior guard, hails from Montreal, played his high school ball here in the GTA area, was on the prep scene, very good player, very accomplished player at the college level as well in terms of being a rotation piece from the time he was a freshman to having starting opportunities. For Oregon to accomplish anything, they're going to need him. They desperately need him. He's kind of the forgotten piece of that puzzle for the Oregon Ducks. Everybody talks about, if you are one of those folks that when you've looked at the bracket all week long in preparation for this weekend, and you have gone against the upset of Liberty, a 12, beating Oregon, a 5, all of that conversation has been geared towards three things, Donovan. One, Dana Altman, inevitable in March, the head coach. Number two, Nate Biddle, 7-footer, bigger than anybody that Liberty can throw at him, and their best player, and Jackson Shellstead, who's got a little bit of that zest for the moment. He's got a great feel. He rises to the occasion. He embraces those moments, or as Bill Rafferty would call it, onions, baby. He's got the onions, sophomore guard, but everybody then conveniently overlooks who's the other piece of that equation and starts and is a prominent piece. It's Keyshawn Bartholomew. And he does all the little things with his ability to allow Jackson Shellstead to create offense on his own, to get away from the ball, to initiate offense, defensive end guarding and playing that an elite level in terms of his on-ball pressure. People are overlooking that element. So I think he's a really, really important player if Oregon has aspirations of once again making a little bit of a push and a run here and certainly surviving through the first weekend. And the second guy I'll sort of single out here, because in terms of pro potential, this is the individual that has the most upside of anybody in the draw. And you might watch, and maybe you'll be a little underwhelmed at times, because I've seen it throughout the course of the season. Will Riley is the best prospect available, Canadian prospect participating in this tournament. Plays for Illinois. He's a freshman. Five-star player coming out of his high school career. And he ends up signing on to play for Brad Underwood at Illinois. He's got all the size and the tools. He's 6'8", 6'9", physical traits. He shoots the three pretty reasonably well. But he's got a lot of, how do I say it, the babyish sort of body traits. You know, he's thin, he's lanky, but he's thin. He's got the baby face on him. You can really tell he's a young kid. And yet there have been games this season where he's looked like the best player on the floor. And then there have been other instances, Donovan, where he looks completely out of place and struggles to create his own shot. And his perimeter, his jumper isn't falling and the defense isn't there. So we've seen both sides of the ledger with him. I think it could be either, really, Illinois as a whole, this sort of maybe is a microcosm for what they are as a team, which is they're kind of caught in the middle. They're either going to be really good, or they might even get bounced in the first round with how things go with Illinois. And look no further than what happened just a week ago in the Big Ten tournament, where they got absolutely throttled by Maryland, a loss by almost 30 points in I believe it was the quarterfinals at that point. But Will Riley is definitely the most intriguing Canadian prospect on the board. If we're talking about futures and pro potential and a guy that can be an NBA first-round draft pick, he's the guy. He's the guy. He's the one that has the best physical traits and tools and certainly the profile of somebody that's going to have an opportunity to play in the NBA.
Didn't end up having the NBA career that many had hoped, but I would argue if you have any NBA career, that's a success. But would a fair comp for him be someone who played in the same conference, a Nick Stauskas?
I don't think so. I don't know that I see a Nick Stauskas in him. I think Nick was a little smaller.
Mm-hmm.
I think Nick was more certainly shooting-oriented. You know, the one that comes to mind, I kind of like him better than this one, though. You know, Caleb Houston, who's a recent example, but Caleb Houston went to Michigan, played at Montverde Academy, where he had the opportunity to share the spotlight with guys like, you know, Cade Cunningham, even Scotty Barnes. Like, he was on some really good teams, highly, highly touted. For me personally, I knew, you know, even from watching him when he was in high school, Caleb Houston could always shoot the three ball. That was never a question. That jumper was there. But I questioned other aspects of his game. I wasn't so convinced in terms of his level to his ability to generate his own offense, the offensive creation, the skill set, I never felt was fully there. I think Will Riley is more advanced in that area than what Caleb Houston would have been. I think he shoots it maybe not quite as well as Caleb Houston does and did when he played in college, but very similar to me in terms of the size, the makeup, the build, and the overall skill set. So to me, I think that it's a more recent example, but I feel like that is maybe a more apt comparison, because when you watch, there will be games where they kind of disappear. Caleb had that happen a lot. And then all of a sudden, when you kind of least expect it after maybe they've gone cold for 2-3 games, boom, here's a 20 spot, right? And mm-hmm. and you're saying, oh my gosh, look at the size and the length, the athleticism, and they're shooting it, pulling the defense out. It gets you bought back in again. So he reminds me of that type of prospect.
Speaking of prospects, everyone, you know, is failing for Flag. This is the time of year we are in the NBA where Raptors fans are beside themselves when they reel off a winning streak and a bunch of those wins against other teams who are really bad. He clearly, if he decides to come out, and there's been some conversation led by himself that he might go back for his sophomore year. I'm skeptical that that is the case, because the answer to all questions is money. And despite the fact that NIL is a real thing and can mitigate the difference, obviously, historically, but even now, between what you make in your first year and your entry deal and what you can make going back to school. The fact is, as Coach Calipari has often told his players, you get out because it's not about the first contract, it's about getting to the second, and getting to that second contract as fast as possible. Having said that, in this tournament, the way the field has been set, who are the prospects that could really help themselves and get in the conversation? Because I mentioned some of the bigger Canadian prospects over the last couple of years. March Madness, part of the charm would be, all right, we get to see this test run of future NBA players. Over the last couple of years, because there have been so many international players in the lottery of the draft, it hasn't really had that same impact. The international class doesn't seem to be as strong this year. So who are you expecting to make a real strong case for themselves going into the spring's draft?
I'll tell you the ones that have the best platform to do it. Mm. The guys that have the best opportunity based on sort of the quality of their team and perhaps the runway they're going to get from playing multiple games, ideally. I think the Duke guys in general have a really, really good platform. You know, Cooper Flagg, he's his own animal. Forget about him for a second. I think it's obvious with him. But, you know, a guy like Con Knipple, who people have grasped, he's a really good player. I don't know that they fully have embraced yet how good of a player he can be. Because there's this shadow that is cast by the aura of Cooper Flagg. So a guy like him, a guy like even, you know, Kamen Maluwak, who he's drawn more interest because the big man market in general is not as deep. And so you've got him and a guy like Derek Queen, who I'm also really fond of, that are leading the charge when it comes to the top bigs available in this draft. But I feel like Con Knipple is the one, when I look at where things stand, for me, he's got the opportunity to not necessarily, his stock's not going to tank at all, like by whatever happens. He could go shoot 1-for-7 from three. Duke loses. But guess what? I think the majority of our conversation is going to be centered around how did Cooper Flagg perform, right? What let them down ultimately? And I don't know that Con Knipple is going to be front and center in that regard. But I can assure you, if Con Knipple and Duke make their run, he's going to be prominently involved in all of it. And I do believe a lot of the hype, a lot of the conversation surrounding Cooper Flagg has put Con Knipple in a position where, although the draft experts and scouts and even college basketball hardos like myself are well aware of how important he is, now you're going to see it on a big stage how vitally important he truly is as a player. Because the reputation for him, Donovan, is a guy that just shoots threes. He's got terrific size. He shoots the cover off the ball, and that is true. But what's underrated about his game is he's a dog on the defensive end. Mm-hmm. And also, in addition to that, he's not a guy that, to use even Raptors comparison, Grady Dick stood in a corner at Kansas, right? Very, very limited ability to create when the ball was in his hands. It was all catch and shoot, make smart, intentional, good decisions, cutting to the basket, and that's where his offense came from. Con Knipple is able to say, all right, give me the ball. You want me to run pick and roll? Sure, I'll run pick and roll. You want me to go and attack a big in a mismatch? I'll attack the big in the mismatch. I have no issues. I think his game is just more well-rounded than people give him credit for. So that's one guy I am particularly fond of, and I think the opportunity will bode well for him in this tournament. Derek Queen, I mentioned him. I think he's a guy that if you're the Raptors or other teams that you feel are in need of a big, and you're picking anywhere in that top 15, maybe top 12 upwards, look at him. You know, come on, Maluwak is and regardless of what mock draft you go by or various ranking systems and whoever it may be, he's routinely the number one guy atop the board for bigs. And I get it. He's 7'2", right? He's got all the athletic tools, but super raw. Super raw. No skill. No finesse. It's all athleticism only. Derek Queen is... Yeah, he's shorter, 6'10", 6'11". Guess what, though? He literally loves playing with the ball in his hands. He loves being able to set screens and roll. He loves being able to step outside the three-point line to act as a passer. His vision, underrated. He can also, I think, be a decent rim protector with his ability to move. He's mobile for his size, similar to Kaman Maluwaka, is just smaller. And so I'm also really, really keen and fond of Derek Queen. Have watched him a ton this year. That's another guy that really jumps out to me as somebody that I'm impressed with. I will throw one other name at you, and unfortunately we're not going to get to see him play in the tournament because they were in the first four and his team just lost. But I think if Trey Johnson had the opportunity to play an NCAA tournament game, it would turn people on to, man, oh man, this guy is just a pure walking bucket. He scores at all three levels, and he can do it in the most creative manner possible. Are there holes in his game? Yes. But you know what a player like that tends to do when they get to the NBA? They tend to thrive because it's all about their athleticism and their pure shot-making ability. And that guy might be the best pure shot maker in the sport this season. And certainly among all the prospects at the top of the draft, that young man in Trey Johnson might be the best natural pure scorer there is. We know NBA, all about putting the ball in the basket, scoring points. And he can do it just as good as anybody. And oh, by the way, 6'6", 6'7" frame with good length, and his body's going to get bigger as he gets older. He did it as a freshman, leading the SEC in scoring. I would tend to bet he's going to be a really good scorer at the next level.
When you look at the bracket and you look at the potential roads to get to the Final Four, what is the most treacherous? You mentioned, obviously, the Midwest and what that looks like for Houston. I look at the West and I say, in the same region, out the gate, you have three Hall of Fame coaches in Arkansas with Coach Cal, obviously Kansas with Bill Self, and then sitting there waiting for the winner of that game in Providence, you've got what Rick Pitino has done at St. John's. All three have won a championship before. When you look at the bracket, where do you see the trickiest region to get to San Antonio, never mind win the whole thing?
Yeah, so, I mean, we already went through Houston. That would probably be the one for me just because of, again, that second-round matchup. I'm so conflicted and torn if we do end up getting Houston-Gonzaga, what that may look like. But next to that, I'm actually going to go, I like what you alluded to there. And I'll also throw even another name just for the West. Obviously, UConn, Dan Hurley. I know they're at the top,
right,
but think about, you know, even Florida, Todd Golden, who has a great team, but this is his first time having legitimate expectations going into a tournament. Well, Dan Hurley's won two of these back to back, and he's been in the tournament a bunch over the years. And so if you have to play a Dan Hurley UConn team in the second round as Florida, I still think they're the vastly superior team. But nevertheless, that's a matchup you would probably want to avoid. So just even another terrific coach with an awesome resume in that West region. In the South, I am very interested and fascinated with Michigan State. I'm a huge Tom Izzo guy. I love Tom Izzo. I would love to see him win another championship before he retires. I love the quote he had last year after they lost where he talked, "I'm going to die trying." Like, he's like, people ask him about retiring and he's like, no. I will literally die on the court if I have to, because I promise myself I'm going to push and see, I'm going to give it everything to get back to that stage again. And I feel like the second round might even be tricky. You know, they have a young team, right, Donovan? Their best players, yeah, they've got Jaden Akins, who's a senior and has been around, and he's been a part of some of these runs over the years with the likes of Tyson Walker and A.J. Hogard. Those guys are gone now. And part of the reason you really liked Michigan State in those years where they had sort of up and down tumultuous regular seasons is because they had really good veteran guard play. Their guard play is good, but it's young, right? It's Jace Richardson, son of Jason Richardson, who's also a really, really compelling, interesting NBA prospect, very attractive option potentially as a lottery pick in the upcoming draft, but he's a freshman. It's Jeremy Fierce, freshman, who can't shoot the ball for his life. Good defender, good playmaker, can't shoot. Now we get into, you're leaning on Trey Holloman to be the guy in the backcourt for Michigan State. They don't have any separators in their front court. They have a really good front court. They have a nice mix, but they don't have any true separators, difference makers when you look at some of the competition they're going to face in this tournament. So as much as I would love to be the one to say, I'm penciling in Tom Izzo for a long, sustained run here, I could see them making an Elite Eight. I could see them challenging for the Final Four. But I could also see them going out in round two. You play, whether it's a veteran Marquette team under Shaka Smart or a surging New Mexico team, right? I think there are potential opportunities in that second round. Out of all the two seeds, I feel the most precarious position of any of them is kind of what Michigan State is looking at. Because not even, let's say they do survive, not if they get to a Sweet 16. Well, are you playing Iowa State or North Carolina maybe?
Mm-hmm.
And then what? The road is tough. I feel like their path is a little bit more challenging and difficult to get back to that stage where Tom Izzo will have an opportunity to compete in another Final Four. It's a young team, and my general rule of thumb is, A, do you have really good guard play? They do, but here's the other rule of thumb I try to subscribe to. Is your team littered with a lot of veteran players? Do you have maybe one or two star freshmen, but you have all the vets? And the answer for them is not really. Their best players are all young players. Jace Richardson is probably their best guy. He's a freshman. Do I trust that guy to give me 5-6 games of consistent production night in, night out when your teams are scheming and scouting against you for a week in advance leading up to a Sweet 16 game? That's where I think maybe the road is a little bit more challenging, and I don't see a sustained run for Michigan State here.
Okay. So before we take a break, I want to know who you do see a sustained run by. Two-part question, and the answer could be the same. Who do you think will win it, and who do you think is the best bet to win it, which are not necessarily the same thing, especially because of the way the public money has moved. There's a recency bias to this conversation where all year we were talking about Auburn and Duke, Duke and Auburn, back and forth. Auburn comes into the tournament not playing their best basketball, although against really good opponents. Duke, a public team, but the injury questions from multiple players, as you mentioned. And Florida just continued to have compound interest throughout the year and get better and better and better. And now they are the pick du jour for every analyst that goes on TV. So who do you think wins it, and who do you think is the best bet to win it?
Okay. I've given this a lot of thought, invested a lot of time, because I would say when the bracket first came out, my initial instinct, and even after watching, the last few weeks, I've sort of tried to zero in on, hey, which teams do I think have a legitimate chance to win it, right? Every year, I feel like maybe there's a different moment. Sometimes it's earlier in the season than later where I kind of have that aha. I'm like, that's the team. Like, for me, it's like, that's the team. Now, this year, a little different. I was very much starting to buy in to Florida. I think Florida's really good. I think they're the most balanced, complete team across the board. I love the level of experience they have. There's still some degree of baked-in continuity because, you know, guys like Will Richard and Walter Clayton have been there for multiple seasons now, and they are seemingly really peaking at the right time. Even though they've been super consistent, they're peaking at the right time. I'll just put it this way. I think that the number ones are really good. I think I will have Auburn going to the Final Four. I will have Florida making it to the Final Four. I will also have Duke making it to the Final Four. The one that is going to be different for me will be that East region where I, or excuse me, not the East, the Midwest, where I won't have Houston going, and I will throw the little wrench of saying, I'm going to go and bet on a little bit of experience and continuity, and I think if Gonzaga can get past Georgia and get past Houston, then I like their path to potentially make it to the Final Four, them or Tennessee. Tennessee, boy, Rick Barnes, is he ever going to do it? Is Rick Barnes ever just even going to taste the Final Four with Tennessee? Maybe this is the year because he's got a really good, stout defensive team with a lot of veterans that have also been around on his roster for the last few seasons. So they are somebody else I wouldn't sleep on. And then my overall pick, I'm going to go with the Duke Blue Devils. It kind of runs counter to what I traditionally like to do in terms of picking a lot of experience on championship caliber teams. But this is a really, really good Duke team. John Shire, at one point or another, is going to break through. He's going to get this team to a Final Four. He's going to win this team a national championship. He's too good of a coach to do it. He's been the right choice as the successor to Coach Mike Krzyzewski. And I really like the dynamic they have with this group. Big fan of, obviously, Cooper Flagg, but we talked about Con Knipple earlier, and it's not like they are completely devoid of veterans, right? Tyrese Proctor is probably their best guard and certainly their most seasoned guard. He's been around. He's played in this tournament. He's had experience going to the Sweet 16 and even beyond with the Duke Blue Devils. And then you throw in the depth, and even you want to talk veteran presence, a guy like Mason Gillis, who played for Purdue for years, was part of some heartbreak and then some triumph with Purdue. He's also on this roster. I think some of the veterans that are on this team will be enough to compensate for the youth that is on this roster. So I like Duke. I think Florida's the popular, sexy pick right now. If you are interested in taking a team that isn't a top betting boards to do it, certainly I would say consider going with Florida to make a national championship game. I think that's certainly in the cards. But I do feel like Duke is poised to get through, and I really like their chances. I like the team that they have and the way they play stylistically. I know everybody hates the ACC, but when you've only lost, what, 3-4 games all year, you're beating up on everybody. There's a reason for that. You have a really good basketball team.
Best offense, best defense in the ACC for the first time for that program. Top 5 in offensive and defensive efficiency in the country. The last 3 teams that could say that, they went on to become national champions. It totally makes sense. I'm a bit torn because we have seen Duke teams with big-time stars and big-time pro prospects, whether it is Jason Tatum or Zion Williamson and R.J. Barrett or Kyrie Irving, get to the tournament and not get it done. And is Cooper Flagg the next version of that? Or is he this year's Carmelo Anthony?
The one thing I'll just add on to that point, the reason I feel like Cooper Flagg might be different, his game is so much different than the traditional sort of ordinary, typical consensus number one pick. Like he's not the Ace Bailey, Dylan Harper type, where those guys, their impact as players is going to be felt most felt based on what they do with their scoring. And to an extent, it's the presence offensively that they're bringing. Cooper Flagg, what I really like about his game as I've watched him more and more, it's a mixture of some of the intangibles with feel, and also he's such a really underrated passer and facilitator. And you could see he loves digging in on the defensive end. Like, that guy's going to go and play in the NBA, and he's going to block shots. Like, he's gonna have a nose for the basketball. He's a little different for me. And I was very, like, for example, we talk about the RJ team, right? The RJ Duke team. The one glaring flaw with the RJ Duke team, as talented as they were, the depth was questionable, and they couldn't shoot. They couldn't shoot for their lives. This Duke team can really snipe. This Duke team can really shoot it. They meet a lot of metric standards that you look for in identifying potential championship teams. Florida meets that criteria. Auburn meets that criteria, certainly. But whether you go by KenPom metrics, net rating, offensive, defensive efficiency, you go by historical precedents in terms of, you know, three-point shooting rate. Like, Duke checks so many boxes of trends that support picking a team like that to be a national championship contender, to be standing there potentially cutting down the nets. Like I said, I've gotten so compelled to the point where I'm running counter my own theory about picking the veteran teams to do it. I'm willing to roll the dice on a team like Duke because I feel like their freshman group is just a little bit different. It's got a different flavor than some of the star freshmen that are one and done elsewhere playing for different programs.
Can't wait. This is why this time of year is so compelling, because you can make a great case for a lot of teams, and it's not always the best team over the body of work of the season that cuts down the nets. It's really the best team for 3 different mini tournaments. You got to go in and win 2 games at one site and then survive in advance and try to do it again. Can't wait to see what happens. Can't wait to see how my bracket is busted this year. With lots of intrigue on the men's side, there's a lot of intrigue on the women's side, which pushed the men in terms of TV ratings a year ago. Will that be the case This year, after the break, we catch up with Sabrina Merchant to break down the women's bracket and everything that's going on in the WNBA with the Toronto Tempo. Stay with us.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson is a show.
And I'm so happy that you are listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that he had a show. Thank you.
As much grandma and granddad, and the women's bracket is just as fascinating as the men's. So we're going to give it just as much time to help us break it down. Sabrina Merchant, writer for The Athletic on all things women's basketball, joins us. Let's go deep.
Well, this is my favorite time of year, and not because I'm super excited that F1 has started or the Masters are around the corner. It's because we get to fill out brackets, and after the first half a day of competition, rip them up. And that is true generally on the men's side. I have a feeling it might be true on the women's side. Sabrina, I want your take and really your help and expertise before I submit any brackets. But first and foremost, as a Blue Devil, what side of the bracket are the Dukies going to be going further in? Can we see dual championships? Carolina?
You know, I'm at the point where I have two Duke Final Four teams, but I haven't gotten as far as, you know, two banners coming up this year. But I think gotta favor the men to go a little bit farther this year. But I wouldn't be surprised if the women were also on their way to the Final Four this season.
Well, it was very humble of you, as everyone I know that is a Wolverine or a Longhorn is at this point saying that they're going to win on both sides. Something that maybe historically only UConn Husky alums would have been able to really believe when they said it. Yeah. Now we're seeing more programs being really good on both sides. Why don't we start there, you know, in terms of our Canadian audience with Duke? Because you got an ACC Freshman of the Year that is Canadian. You got a couple Freshmen of the Year, major conferences on the women's side that is Canadian. This class in general, a lot of great freshmen, a lot of real great Canadian freshmen across the board. But have you been surprised? I think we all knew that Swords was going to have a good year in her first year. Are you surprised at how well Fournier has been able to adapt to this level?
Not at all, really. I mean, I remember watching her in the Nike Hoop Summit a little while back, and she just really popped with her level of athleticism. And I think you've continued to see that with her at Duke, even in a really good conference like the ACC. What I've really enjoyed about Toby over the course of the season is that she has stopped like looking for contact as much when she tries to finish and just goes through and tries to score. Would love to, you know, watch her learn how to pass at some point. I think she has like 9 assists on the entire season. But hey, you know, when you're good at something, you're good at something. And, you know, on a Blue Devils team that really doesn't have a lot of great big depth, you know, I think the player they expected to be their starting center, Ariana Roberson, got injured during the preseason and hasn't played at all this year. So to have Fournier really anchoring in the front court has been super impressive. Just the way she can score, the way she can defend with her lateral mobility has just been awesome. And like you mentioned, the Canadian freshmen all across the country, like Sila Swords, and in my neck of the woods, I live in Los Angeles, we've got Avery Howell here at USC, who's just been wonderful as well. It's pretty cool, and it sets up, you know, for some nice US-Canada rivalry and international basketball coming down the road too.
Yeah, I don't know if we're there yet.
You gotta start somewhere, you know?
Yeah, and we're starting in soccer and hockey. I don't know if we're there yet in basketball on the women's side, but mine did go, you know, in terms of, you know, Swords already playing on the national team. You got Howell, who was close. You know, Prosper has spent time on the national team. Mm-hmm. Obviously, she's more of an upperclassman. When you add, you know, someone like Fournier and Swords, when they're much older, if some of the vets playing now can hold on, it could be a pretty impressive group. But there's a gap between, you know, the Aaliyah Edwards and Letitia Mejias who've gone through the NCAA and are now WNBA, and this crop who could be the next group to play in the W. I want to focus on this Michigan team, because you could have two Canadians playing for the national team. And that's not even including the Canadian that's helping them coaching with Natalie
Chanwa.
This is the team that many Canadians are going to be rooting for. Another difficult conference, but a young team. What do you make of what those Canadians have been able to do to impact this team and how far they might be able to go in the tournament?
The Michigan freshmen, to me, when you have, you know, Swords, Neil Holloway, Olivia Olson, who was a co-Big Ten freshman of the year alongside Jelani Cambridge, they're just so fearless. Like, and that's unsurprising when you think of a player like Silas Swords, who came from playing in Paris at the Olympics and just jumped right into college basketball. And this is not to say that it's necessarily easier than the international game, but she's already accustomed playing at this level of physicality and against veterans and people who have a ton of experience. So nothing really seems to phase her when it comes to the college level. And I think you saw that from the very beginning of the season when Michigan played South Carolina on opening night and, you know, were within single digits at the end of the game, which was pretty dramatic considering South Carolina hadn't really had any single digit games in the entirety of their undefeated season when they won the national title a year ago. So that's just been really noteworthy, I think, especially from the Michigan freshmen, is how game they are for any situation. And, you know, you look at a player like Sila, who I think gets a lot of attention for her handle and like the way she can get to the basket, and she's really crafty in her finishes. But defensively, I think she's just been awesome. During the Big Ten tournament, she really got in Juju Watkins' like airspace during their matchup in the semifinals. And I'm not sure that like USC was particularly prepared for that, because during their first meeting in the regular season, Sila was unable to play. So I think just the upside she has on both sides of the ball is really, really impressive. And to think that like her sister could be coming, and everyone says that Savvy's supposed to be better than Sila, which is mind blowing to even think about. There's a lot for Canadians to look forward to, I guess, on this Wolverines roster.
Yeah, just family affair, certainly with that family, with, you know, her father playing for the national team, and you know, Cassandra Prosper of Notre Dame's brothers in the NBA, and
Mila right.
Holloway. Yeah, is you know, her brother Aiden Holloway is trying to win a title with Alabama. So evidently, we just have a couple really good families in Canada basketball that are carrying the entire country.
It's a good base to start with, you know.
For sure. When we talk about, you know, this tournament, I want to broaden out a little bit and talk about the visibility of it and the fact that people are filling out both brackets and wagering on both sides, obviously not at the same level, but at increased level. There was a fear after we saw the ratings last year, certainly in the Final Four rival, what we saw on the men's side, that, well, that might just be the Caitlin Clark effect and a little bit of a hangover. What do you expect this year? We still have box office names like a Juju Watkins and a Paige Beckers. We've seen added investment in terms of the conversation leading up to the tournament, and quite frankly, maybe most importantly, the priority positioning on linear TV, both in promoting it and in broadcasting it. But what do you expect in terms of what we might see from some of the viewership numbers and the other metrics that we use to determine how popular the sport is?
Yeah, so during the regular season, I think there was year-over-year growth, actually, from, you know, what we saw during Caitlin and Angel's last season into this season. A lot of those numbers are obviously influenced by the fact that ESPN carries the majority of college basketball games, and the Big Ten is not affiliated with ESPN, so Caitlin's games are not on ESPN, so the ESPN ratings have gone up, because until the tournament, they weren't carrying Caitlin Clark. But I think you saw, you know, Juju Watkins versus Paige Beckers, USC UConn in December did great numbers. I think over 2 million on Fox when that game aired. And we've seen just a lot of big tentpole games throughout the season, like South Carolina UConn did really well. And even the game that it led into, Texas LSU, carried like a million people in its ratings too. So for a team like Texas, which isn't historically regarded as a women's basketball like fan favorite, to keep so much of the audience from South Carolina UConn, I think, was a really impressive thing. When we're thinking about what this tournament is going to do ratings-wise, I would imagine that you know, we're not going to see a 19 million number in the final that outpaces what the men's final gets. That would just be a little too high of an expectation, especially since I think the biggest draw is going to happen during the Elite Eight with Paige Beckers and Juju Watkins, if that matchup ends up materializing. So I would expect growth from the 2023 version of the tournament, but I think just because it might fall short of what was a historic moment in 2024 doesn't mean that there hasn't been significant progress, at least when you consider, you know, where we've come from over the last five to 10 years.
We talk about Beckers because people are really excited to see her at the next level. And this is, you know, what the last version of her we'll see as a collegiate player. When we look at mock draft, is there anything that could happen that would move her off of the proverbial number one spot? And are there other players in the tournament, maybe like a FUD, who could change their stock when we look at what the draft coming in right after essentially the finals might look like?
The only way Paige Beckers is not the number one pick in the WNBA draft is if she returns to school for 2025-2026. With all due respect to everybody else in the class, there's a certain body of work that Beckers has put forward. You know, the UConn pedigree obviously works in her favor considering the success of Huskies in the WNBA. There is, again, zero chance that the team with the number one pick does not select Paige Beckers if she is eligible to be selected. As far as other players who could make some noise, you know, in the tournament and boost their draft stock, I think you picked a good one with AZ Fudd, who just doesn't have a lot of games on her record, right? She's been injured for so much of her UConn tenure that she hasn't really put forth a good, solid tournament because she hasn't been healthy in a lot of them. And I think for her to play well for, if you're a UConn fan, six games in a row would be really important in terms of moving her up on WNBA evaluators' boards. I think the North Carolina State guards could benefit themselves similarly in the tournament. Isaiah James, you know, one of the knocks I hear on her is just a lack of consistency. So putting together 2-3 week run of good games could help her shake some of those doubts. Unfortunately, like a lot of the other players who have knocks against them, it's mostly like size considerations. Like Georgia Amor is not going to grow 3 inches in the next 3 weeks. Like that's not going to happen either, Sunisa Morrow. So I'm not sure what they can do to really improve their evaluations in mock drafts. But I would say, you know, like you said, Flood is a good name. Isaiah James and I Rivers, like those are people that I've had my eye on. If they can have good tournament runs, that could boost them 2-3 spots in this upcoming draft.
Mention all those great Huskies that have had great collegiate careers, gone on to have long WNBA careers and start internationally. I can't remember a truly transcendent UConn women's player that didn't leave with at least one title banner, if not multiple. What will it mean for the legacy of the elite players on this team if they aren't able to get it done?
I mean, you're absolutely right. Like, even though UConn hasn't won a title since 2016, you know, Nafisa Collier was a freshman on that team. So she, as one of the WNBA's best players, does have that part on her resume of, you know, having won title back in 2016. There just aren't good UConn players that didn't win a title, right? Like, the history of UConn is such that every player graduates with multiple Final Fours and a national championship. And the ones that we've seen that have graduated in this fallow period, so to speak, haven't really reached the generational level. Like, with all due respect to Aaliyah Edwards, I don't know that she's going to be regarded as one of UConn's very best. Like, similarly with Olivia Nelson Adota or Crystal Dangerfield, like good WNBA players, but not of the echelon that Paige Beckers aspires to. So I think no matter what kind of WNBA career or pro career she hopes to have, this is a box that she has to check. Like, she knows how much it means. She wants to bring a national championship back to Connecticut. And I think it's part of why she wanted to stay for that fifth year, to know that she could have a fully healthy season, her and AC, and finally deliver on the promise that, you know, was expected when she agreed to come to Connecticut back in 2020.
We've gone this long without talking about the Gamecocks, which in some ways seems criminal, as you know, they are right now probably, you know, the biggest sustained brand in the sport. Dawn Staley was not happy with their seeding, maybe with their draw, and made some comments in terms of changes that they'll make potentially to their out-of-conference schedule moving forward. Is that sentiment valid? And the way you see it, who has the toughest draw to the Final Four?
Yeah, I'm not sure I necessarily agree with Don Staley in this regard, because the only team seated ahead of them is one that beat them pretty convincingly in UCLA. And I think it was a better version of South Carolina that they beat, actually, because Ashlyn Watkins was still healthy, and now she has torn her ACL and is not available for the NCAA tournament. So I don't really know what Don's argument was in this particular instance, although I completely understand going back for your team. I think they actually got a pretty reasonable draw. Obviously, I'm a homer when it comes to Duke, but in terms of the two seeds, I don't know that Duke is the one that is best suited to take down South Carolina. It's not like they got, you know, UConn or something. And North Carolina, again, a bit of a homer, I think is about the weakest three seed in the draw when you compare them to LSU or TCU or even Oklahoma out in the Spokane Four Regional. So I kind of think the Gamecocks have a pretty clear path back to the Final Four. Maybe they feel disrespected because they're not in the top left corner of everyone's brackets, but the games align pretty nicely for them to get back to the Final Four for what would be the fifth consecutive season.
Once the field was announced and the bracket was announced, there was some conversation that maybe the bracket didn't optimize for marquee matchups as late as possible, and that maybe they could have played with the seed line a little bit more in order to make sure that the most box office of teams and of players definitely made it to the Final Four, if not the final. I feel like that's only the thing that we say in the women's side. We don't complain when there's a bunch of Hall of Fame coaches in the same region in the you know, first two rounds of the NCAA bracket on the men's side. Given how wild the tournament can end up being, is that a valid concern? Do we need to be tweaking things to make sure the audience grows as big as it might?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, personally, I looked at the draw and I saw if the one seeds were to hold chalk, we would get the fourth meeting between USC and UCLA in the Final Four, and the fourth meeting between Texas and South Carolina in the Final Four. And would it have been so difficult to just swap USC and Texas and then, you know, avoid those rematches until the absolute final, in which case you could only get one, not two of them. So I do understand the frustration with these rematches. And unfortunately, rematches are just going to come more often because of these mega conferences. These teams just play each other more often during the regular season. And I understand that the committee wants to be as fair as possible in assigning these seeds and these placements, but I do think there could be some consideration given to just what do these potential matchups mean. Like, I look at Notre Dame, you know, in the Birmingham Three region, and like, they've already played Texas, they've already played TCU, you know, and if those are the two matchups that are going to headline your region and they're rematches of what we've seen during the regular season, it's just, to me, not as exciting. So I would hope that the committee going forward has some sense, like, now that we're in this mega conference era, that there's going to have to be a little bit more playing around with the seeds, or I guess just with the regions, because I mean, people can say like, oh, wouldn't you want to see USC versus UCLA again? Like, I don't know. I've seen it three times. Like, I kind of know what it looks like. I'd rather see some other options.
No question. Toronto basketball fans are going to be super locked in to the men's tournament, hoping that one of the great players falls to them in the draft. Toronto Tempo fans, maybe not as locked in, as, you know, a lot of these great players who are going to be drafted are going to be locked in to contracts and not available to them via free agency. But they are starting to build a foundation. They have a name and a logo and a color scheme and a general manager and a very famous investor and owner in Serena Williams. What have you made of what Teresa Resch and company have done to build the Tempo, you know, brick by brick, even though we're still over a year away from them being able to build the actual team?
You know, other than the one minor hiccup of the team appearing on the WNBA website before the name actually could be announced, I love the name. I love the branding. I think it's going to be really fun. I'm a huge fan of alliterations. And the WNBA is obviously very partial to collective noun team names. So Go Tempo, I like the idea quite a bit. I'm a huge fan of Monica Wright Rogers, just so highly regarded in the WNBA, the work that she was able to do in Phoenix and at the league level the last few years. Just can't speak highly enough of the personnel hires they've made so far. And like the fact that we know that there is already a fan base in Toronto just based on the draw for the exhibition game a couple of years ago, I think it's gonna be awesome. Just I couldn't be more excited about a team entering that market. And, you know, do I think that like it's going to be necessary to have a couple Canadian teams just to juice fan base? I think they're going to be just fine regardless of who ends up on that inaugural roster. And, you know, pay attention to the tournament because there are great, great juniors who are going to be available in that 2026 draft to already have your eye on and, you know, start to think of as your own.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see what the rules are around that draft and the expansion teams and where they pick. Because, yeah, to your point, there will be some transformational players in that draft, assuming they decide to come out. I'm really actually somewhat bullish that this team has a pathway to compete right away for a couple of reasons. One, because of the CBA and where it is and the amount of high-level players that are going to be free agents at the same time, something that I don't think we've seen in any sport historically. Because they have the ultimate closer in Serena Williams being able to call a free agent and saying, hey, do you need help with some marketing, some branding, how to be a boss as a female, some financial advice? I got you covered on all those bases. It would be tough, you know, not to take that really seriously. And three, because I actually think the international nature of the country might be appealing to some players on the women's side, where it has been a detriment in terms of building an NBA roster. Do you think the pathway to success could be quick, or do you think we should temper expectations?
You know, it's tricky because I look at Golden State and I think they felt similarly about their pathway to success being pretty quick in terms of their ability to attract free agents. And it just didn't work out for them in the way they thought it would in their inaugural season. Admittedly, the offseason is going to look a lot different next year with the implementation of a new CBA and everyone being free agents and having the ability to move freely in a way that just wasn't possible this year when most of the best players moved via sign and trade and Golden State just had no assets to provide in the sign and trade. So I think that'll benefit Toronto. I do agree with you that the WNBA player pool is just more internationally friendly than the NBA player pool. Like, so many of these players have played overseas and I think are more amenable to the idea of playing in a place that's not the US. And there is so much of the, you know, 156 players who are international, and to them playing in the United States versus Canada is like a marginal difference, right? Like, you know, why prioritize one over the other? And frankly, Toronto during the summer is a much easier sell than Toronto during the winter. So I think that's going to work in their favor more so than the Raptors have going for them. As far as the Serena Williams thing, as a fan of Angel City, I have not noticed the free agent pull that she has exerted in the NWSL, so I hope for your sake it goes better, but you know, don't hold your breath.
Got it. That's fair. I didn't think of the NGL City aspect, although her TGL golf team is not bad, so maybe she's been able to help there. The aspect of that ongoing negotiation and, you know, the new money theoretically that's coming in, given you know, where the rights are in terms of television and streaming, there's, you know, two sides of this. There's one side saying, well, the pot is growing and we were playing on an antiquated agreement, and so theoretically what the players get in return should grow as well. And then the other side I've heard is, you know, this is still a league with owners who have carried a lot of you know, dead money and equity and lost money for a long time, and so they may not be as willing to change that relationship with the players fiscally. Where do you see this going? Is there any way we could see, you know, a strike, a lockout, a work stoppage, or do you think this will get done pretty quickly?
You know, I don't think the players have ever had more leverage than they do right now, with the product being as popular as it is and brands and companies throwing their weight in terms of investment dollars behind the league. The new media rights deal is about 8 times what the previous one was. So if you just, you know, look at that money and think, well, if, you know, most of the league's revenue comes from media and that's 8 times revenue, then maybe the players should be getting 8 times their salaries as they were in the previous collective bargaining agreement. So I do believe that the players are not going to agree to a lesser deal. Like, I think this is the moment where, regardless of all the momentum that the league is having and the fear of a lockout threatening that, I would imagine that they are going to work very hard to ensure that all of their financial considerations, player experience considerations, you know, just in terms of like standardizing facilities and accommodations on the road and at home, all of those things are like, this is the time where they can negotiate with the most power and get what they're hoping for. So I wouldn't expect this to be quick, because there is a lot that needs to be adjusted. I would imagine that the Players Association does not want to head to a lockout, just, you know, to disrupt the momentum that women's basketball has going, especially when there are all these other women's basketball properties that could seize that momentum in their absence. So I would be surprised if there was a lockout, but I also don't think that this is the kind of thing where we're going to wake up in July and a deal will be done. Like, I imagine this is going to go down to the wire.
You mentioned other leagues and you also mentioned leverage. How much does Unrivaled and the success of that help that leverage?
Yeah, I think what Unrivaled has shown is that when a league has the opportunity to be nimble, you know, not constrained by NBA partnerships and what has historically been done, they can attract a good amount of money. They got a good TV deal. They are able to pay their players a substantial amount of money more than what the WNBA has. So I think the proof of concept that Unrivaled shows is that the WNBA needs to step up its game if it wants its players to prioritize this league versus anything else.
And before I let you go, I want your take on, you know, a story that proactively became a story, and that's Cameron Brink talking about having the ick in the thought of playing against, you know, some training sessions with men, and talking about the fact that they should be pretty vetted. I am really interested, because I saw this story and I was like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. I'm sure there's, you know, some random dudes that, you know, might sign up for this just so that they can guard Cameron Brink in the post. But on the flip side, I thought to myself, bringing in, you know, male players to scrimmage against women has happened often at various levels. It's often happened to get international teams ready for competition in small windows. What did you make, I suppose, of the story, and then of the 2 and 3 day story that her comments became?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, every WNBA team has male practice players. Pretty much every high-level college team has male practice players. There's actually a rule in the WNBA that you cannot have female practice players, because they view it as a violation of the CBA, that you're essentially bringing other women into your organization without paying them via the salary cap. So they have to have male scout players. And I realized that the internet is a terrible cesspool of gross comments, and I would like to believe that the people who are replying on Twitter and Instagram are not the ones who are actually getting selected to work out for the Sparks, and that they have a much better, like you said, vetting system, a much better, you know, way of evaluating who is going to be capable of helping the team achieve its goals. And I can't imagine it's going to be the same players who are making those gross comments on the Los Angeles Sparks Instagram feed. So I understand that, like, Cameron Brink has a new podcast. Her podcast is with Sadell Curry Lee, whose brother is Stephen Curry. Those comments are going to make a lot of attention because of who they are, that platform. And I do understand that, like, when you're Cameron Brink and you're being subjected to this gross stuff on the internet, like, you're going to speak out about it. But the history of practice players in WNBA tells me that just because more men are becoming aware of what that is and are, you know, having their fun in the comments section doesn't mean that those are the kind of people who are going to be part of WNBA organizations.
Yeah, I certainly hope not. All right, before I let you go, your Final Four and your champion in both brackets, who you got?
Okay, I'm going to be perfectly honest. I have not looked at the men's bracket. I will have Duke as my champion, and that's that. You can fill in the other Final Four as however you'd like. On the women's side, I have UCLA. We'll put the Duke women in there, Notre Dame, and UConn, and I have UConn winning it all.
Wow. Well, Gino gets another one, and Paige Beckers gets to ride in the sunset with one. That would be a great story. And having Cooper and Paige both getting one, and, you know, certainly having, you know, dual speeches at the ESPYs when they're named, you know, College Athlete of the Year would be pretty cool. We'd love to see it. I always love your perspective and your insight. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much to Sabrina and Daniele, and enjoy the tournament. Hopefully your brackets are still intact by the time you're listening to this. But if not, just jump into a survivor pool or make some friendly bets. Either way, it's a great watch. Hopefully this was a good listen. Please like, favorite, share, and subscribe. We'll talk to you again soon.